Assalamu alaikum. The A-team of AB and Mustafa has kindly given the Association of Muslim Accountants and Lawyers, AMAL, the big picture. Part one is the joint broadcast on Radio Islam International and Al Ansar. After midday, we will continue on Al Ansar. AMAL will explain the recent Constitutional Court judgment on Muslim marriages, which greatly impacts on the Ummah. The AMAL team for the first stanza is myself, Aslam Ayat, and AMAL President Shabir Chauhan.
Aslam, I think it's very important with such a complex topic that we must state a disclaimer. Legal advice must be obtained from the people's or the listener's own legal consultant and not on this program.
Yeah, Shabir, look, it's more common that the husband is the breadwinner. Often, working women give up jobs to concentrate on having children, managing the home, which allows the husband to build up his estate. Then when the marriage terminates by death or divorce, the wife may be left destitute. Even if she was had professional qualifications, she may be past her sell-by date for the job market. So women who were not married in terms of the civil law in South Africa were prejudiced.
Aslam, there's been so much of litigation on this topic.
Yes, indeed. Look, Muslim women in particular resorted to the courts, which on a case-by-case basis granted the same consequences as a spouse to a civil marriage. But this was time-consuming, expensive, and left many gaps. The Women's Legal Center applied to court, and after a long battle, the Constitutional Court issued the judgment, which ordered the government and parliament to enact legislation to recognize Muslim marriages as valid and to regulate its consequences.
Aslam, I think at this stage maybe you should read out the explanatory summary that was issued by AMAL earlier this week.
Thanks, Shabir. You and AMAL Vice Chair Zain Fakhruddin signed that statement, but Aslam must do the donkey work for you. The judgment is in two parts. Interim relief, which applies already, and declarations of invalidity, which are suspended, pending legislation. Now, I will rephrase the AMAL summary, dealing just with the interim relief, leaving the listeners in suspense for the other part, which we will deal with after midday when we are joined by Advocate Zakaria Suleiman, who's AMAL's constitutional law expert. Now, the interim measure, which is part of the court order, is already in operation, but it applies retrospectively to Muslim marriages subsisting at 15 December 2014, or which, even though a talaq may have been issued, are still subject to undecided legal proceedings. So if a person gave a talaq and maybe the wife instituted legal proceedings pursuant thereto, then that still, even if it was given before 15 December 2014, if that case has not yet been decided, the interim measure applies to that person as well. And as I say, all nikahs from 15 December, which were existing from this 15 December, are in the net. So therefore, nikah-only marriages are now subject to the whole of the Divorce Act, with the proviso that the proprietary regime is regarded as out of community of property, unless the couple entered into an agreement to the contrary. So if you're married by civil law, you default without entering into any specific antenuptial contract, you default into incommunity. Whereas if you are married by nikah, you default into out of community, and in either case, unless there's an agreement to the contrary. And more specifically, the interim measure applies that section 7.3 of the Divorce Act, which relates to the redistribution, a just redistribution of assets. So if you are married out of community of property and there's a divorce, in terms of section 7.3, even though you're not accrual, and it didn't matter when, because of the recent court case, if you're married out of community of property, although each party is their own assets, the court could say, look, depending on the length of the marriage, the contribution of the spouses, they would do a redistribution of assets. So that would also now apply to nikahs.
Aslam, there's so many questions, and maybe I must pose some to you. What happens if a man is married to more than one wife?
Well, specifically with regard to this redistribution of assets, if the husband has more than one nikah wife, and that's what this, today's subject is about, nikah marriages, so I'm confining it to that rather than civil marriages. So with regard to redistribution of assets, if the husband is married to more than one nikah wife, the court will make a just and equitable order after considering all relevant factors, including any agreement he may have had with each wife, and also they would join any interested persons.
And what does the interim period mean?
Yeah, the court gave Parliament 24 months to enact legislation recognizing Muslim marriages and governing its consequences. Now, you know, it's not the job of the courts to make legislation. That's the job of Parliament. All the courts can say is that that legislation that you've made is wrong, you need to amend it. It's unconstitutional. And in this case, it's quite groundbreaking where they told Parliament, go and you've got a constitutional obligation to pass legislation recognizing Muslim marriage. So it's quite groundbreaking. But again, the court could not say, this is the legislation you must pass. All it could say is, go and pass legislation. So during this 24-month interim period, there's certain things that already apply, which is Section 12 of the Children's Act and Section 3 of the Recognition of Customary Marriages Act, which applies to Muslim marriages. And the short net effect of that is that this disallows a child below the age of 18 being married or engaged. And of course, there are exceptions if you get the consent of parents or authorized officials or the court. But without those consents, you're disallowed to have a marriage between a child under the age of 18.
Aslam, there's been many women's groups who have welcomed the judgment as a great victory to Muslim women. We have on the line Aisha Royker from the MPL Network, and she will briefly explain the constituency she represents and the MPL Network view on the Constitutional Court judgment.
Yeah, look, Aisha is a candidate attorney whose personal journey for her rights has made her a passionate advocate for the empowerment of and a voice against the systemic injustice of women and children in particular. It has been a long, tough battle. Perhaps the religious and legal brotherhood should accept the blame. So I put up my hand, Me Too movement. It has been left to women's groups on the ground, like Aisha's, the MPL Network, and the Women's Legal Center in particular. So sisters are doing it for themselves. Although it's far from over, there is now, as AB would say, light at the end of the tunnel. Over to you, Aisha.
Assalamu alaikum, Aslam and Shabir, and shukran for having me on the show today. So the MPL Network, we are a national network of diverse Muslim women, bringing together academics, researchers, legal practitioners, and activism. And our work is influenced and guided by the lived experience of the practice of Muslim personal law in South Africa. So our constituency is made up of courageous women and children who have until now been without state protection, members of society who have trusted the constitutional guarantees of the right to freedom and freedom of religion and equality. So as a network, we welcome the latest constitutional court judgment, which after a 27-year battle finally provides for the legal recognition and protection of spouses in a Muslim marriage in South Africa. In your background introduction, you made mention of an example of how Muslim women have been left destitute and impoverished. You know? And from my personal experience, this is indeed the case. After 19 years of marriage, I was left without a cut-and-dried entitlement to a share of assets which my ex-husband and I had accumulated together during the subsistence of our marriage. And this is what we see all too often in the work that we as a network do. And this is why this judgment is so important. Firstly, there's now recognition and confirmation that Muslim marriages, nikahs, are legal. They are valid marriages. This judgment also, you know, affords us the opportunity to institute divorce proceedings under the Divorce Act, which, mind you, we have been doing. Many legal practitioners have been doing it before this, citing the ministers. But this just removes one step of the legal process that we unfortunately have to endure in trying to get a just settlement. So one of the redistribution, Section 73, which you've mentioned, it's important because it can use specifically in, for example, in my case, had it been valid at the time, had I had the option of instituting the divorce proceedings and utilizing Section 73, it would have, any amount that a woman has contributed to the marriage, be it financially, be it part working in the business or staying at home to raise the children, if you could, prove and you could validate this was your contribution, there would be a valid claim for a share of the assets, and the court would need to look at, redistribution. So for us as women that were now left without having this option previously, at least there is something for us now. The wheels of the judiciary, it turns extremely slowly. And the legal system has really been a disservice to women because, I guess to men as well, but the whole system is emotionally, psychologically, financially draining. My matter took almost 6 years to conclude, and we weren't even trial ready. We had to enter into an article settlement. So the whole process is time-consuming. So the network, we really embrace this order. We look forward to, we know that there's a lot of work still to be done. The interim release is there, but what the final result is going to be, what the final legislation is going to be in this 24-month process, we don't know. We look forward to engaging in and participating in the process, and we hope that ultimately it will lead to a humane, sustainable process which will minimize the hardships experienced by women and children in South Africa.
If I could just ask you one question. Your matter was finalized. The court now has said that it's retrospective to 2014. I know nobody knows until things go to court exactly what's going to happen. But can you go back if your marriage was, nikah was subsisting at 2014, could you go back and get a better settlement in the light of this court judgment?
Well, settlements are settlements. They're made orders of the court. So, the terms of the settlements are final. But if there is anybody who was married, had I not settled, I would now have been able to institute divorce proceedings. I would now have had access to interim maintenance, the Rule 43, pending finalization. And this is where a lot of women struggle where we can't afford to go to court because the whole process, there's no guarantees. At least here, you know, if you institute divorce proceedings, you have Rule 43. You can access interim maintenance relief until the matter. Sometimes it's a good thing. You know, it would really force the other party to settle the matter as opposed to dragging it on for 6, 7, 8 years. And for women, you know, if you are exiting a marriage, at least you know that these are, the Divorce Act relates to you, and your attorney can then advise you on what sections are appropriate for you and what you can access accordingly.
Okay. Jazakallah, Aisha, and I think you're quite right as to the answer you gave, because I think the court says that matches which are not, you know, haven't been settled. But Jazakallah, and keep up the good work that the ladies are doing. Shabir, over to you.
Aslam, you know, we've put out a request for the listeners to ask questions, and I must say we've been inundated with the responses prior to this talk, and I will put some to you. In the absence of an agreement to the contrary, nikah marriages default to out of community of property. But let's consider this scenario. You have two nikah wives, with each of whom you agree to be married in community of property. You then nikah a third wife and register a civil marriage in community of property. To make it even more complex, you then conclude a fourth nikah, agreeing to marry her in community of property. The result is that you are in four community marriages.
Yeah. Hi, boy, Shabir. This is a mystery wrapped in an enigma. Can I call a friend? Yeah, you see, as you correctly say, that you, the court says that you you default out of community of property with a nikah, but if you have an agreement, you can marry, you can be married in community. You can vary that out of community regime, and if you married civilly without a contract, so you'd have four community marriages. You know, this is exactly the problem that exists if there's no legislation. Or as is mooted by many, that legislation must merely state that nikah marriages are now regarded as valid marriages, full stop. This judgment is new, and one will have to see how the courts unravel all these problem areas. The Concord, in fact, actually anticipated that there would be problems, because its order states, if problems arise in its implementation, any interested party can apply to the Concord for a variation of this order.
Aslam, so nikah marriages are recognized, that's what's coming out. But what is the effect if one spouse is sequestrated? Quite apart from that, does nikah affect one's tax status?
The short answer is that the judgment has no effect in either of the cases that you referred to. Under Section 21 of the Insolvency Act, if one spouse is sequestrated, all the property of the solvent spouse to him, to whom he was married out of community of property, also vests in the trustee, unless and until the solvent spouse can prove that the property actually belongs to the solvent spouse. So for the purposes of Section 21, a spouse includes a person married by any custom such as nikah. And as far as the Income Tax Act, you talk of tax status, it similarly recognizes nikah marriages. Now this is important because, for instance, donations between spouses are exempt from donations tax. So as stated, the position on insolvency and tax are governed by statute and they remain unchanged.
Aslam, and if I conclude a nikah without any agreement, and day after I register a civil marriage without ANC, what is the applicable marital regime?
Yeah, so you had a nikah, you defaulted without an agreement, you defaulted into out of community. You then register a civil marriage without an ANC, and you default into in community. Can I take a 50-50 on this one? Look, by concluding a nikah without any agreement, as I said, on divorce you default out, And if thereafter you concluded a civil marriage without an NCE, you default into incommunity. I contend that the civil community marriage trumps the Nikah propriety regime. That's an opinion.
And given these uncertainties, is it not advisable to enter into a written contract before or even after concluding a Nikah?
Yeah, look, even prior to this order, the courts were granting persons married by Muslim marriages many of the consequences that applied to civil marriages. I think Aisha even mentioned that. The importance of concluding a written contract to regulate the propriety consequences was always important. And I think after this judgment, it's perhaps even more important. In fact, it is arguably a necessity. So, the simple answer is consult an Amal lawyer.
Thanks, Aslam. Aslam, Pati is married in community under South African law. What would be the simplest way to ensure that one's estate can be distributed as per the Sharia, taking into consideration that both spouses are 100% certain that they want their estate to be distributed as per the Sharia?
Yeah. Look, in South Africa, if you die without a will, you die intestate and South African law would apply. However, we have freedom of testation. And that's where this would come in, because I think, you can unravel this if you're married in community and you wanted to put it in the hands of the true person spouse who actually owned it. There are costs involved, transfer costs and so on. So in South Africa, each party would own one half of the joint community estate. In Islam, it's slightly different. It doesn't really matter whose name is registered on. One has to establish exactly which assets each spouse in truth is the actual owner of. Now, of course, they could both have contributed to some assets, in which case there would be a shared ownership. To answer the question, the parties could execute a joint will. So in the event of a simultaneous death, the both people died at the same time, the assets, which in terms of Islamic law truthfully belong to the husband, will, in terms of the will, they'll bequeath it to his Islamic law heirs. And similarly, the assets which belong to the wife will be bequeathed to her Islamic law heirs. So the Islamic law position would then be put in place. If, on the other hand, one spouse dies first, then the will would provide a joint will that the assets of the deceased, in terms of Islam, which belong to him or him or her in terms of Islamic law, are bequeathed to his or her Islamic law heirs, or the Islamic law heirs of the deceased, and the assets which truly belong to the survivor are bequeathed to the survivor. So that solves that particular issue. On the death of the first dying, in terms of South African law, the survivor is put to an election to either accept or reject the will. Now, if the survivor accepts, then the Islamic law position, as we set out, applies. If, however, the survivor repudiates, then the survivor takes one half share of the estate, and then the Islamic position that they wanted would be undone.
Aslam, does the position change if children from Muslim marriages are regarded as legitimate?
Look, children were always protected. For instance, maintenance and interstate inheritance, they were always getting. The significant improvement of this court judgment is that if an application is made to court to dissolve a Muslim marriage, the state machinery kicks in. Now, Section 6 of the Divorce Act protects the best interests of minor and dependent children, which requires oversight by the court, which then has the benefit of a parental plan, a family advocate report. So the best interests of the children would be protected because Section 6 is part of this interim order. If one went for just the talaq without going to court, there's no legal enforcement mechanisms for the protection of children.
Okay, we have on the line Munir Abdul Rauf. He is an imam, doctorate in philosophy at University of Western Cape, law lecturer, a sworn translator, an attorney, a marriage officer, the CEO of Islamic Business South Africa on the Commission for Promotion of Cultural, Religious and Linguistic Rights. He's a legal advisor and also an ex-co member of the Muslim Judicial Council. He's a direct descendant of Tuan Guru. He has written many academic publications on Muslim marriages. And I'm proud to also say that Munir is a member of the Association of Muslim Accountants and Lawyers.
Sheikh Munir, can you explain the Home Affairs Directive that marriage officers are to register Muslim marriages provided the couple both consent to marry each other under customary law? That's customary African law. Is the fact that nikahs do not need to be registered and that verbal agreements are binding, will it not lead to uncertainty? What is the view of MJC to the judgment, given that South African civil law consequences may differ from Islamic law? And Sheikh Munir, I think recently the Black Muslims issued a fatwa, or rather a guideline, that labola is acceptable provided it's seen as a customary accommodation rather than a Sharia obligation. Over to you, Munir.
Yes, thank you for that, as regards the question, if you're looking at the judgment that was handed down in the Constitutional Court and the directive issued by the Department of Home Affairs. Now, the issue at hand concerns the registration of Islamic marriages under the Recognition of Customary Marriages Act of 1998. Now, that is basically the directive of the Department of Home Affairs. Now, where does this stem from? Now, the Supreme Court of Appeal handed down a judgment on the 18th of December, 2020. Now, in terms of the ECA judgment, it refers to the age and consent requirements before entering into a marriage concluded in terms of Islamic law. And that is now basically the marriages that is concluded at normally at the masajid and so forth. Now, in terms of the sections in that ECA judgment, right, it refers to that both parties to a marriage concluded in terms of Islamic law must, however, have reached the age of 18, and basically they have consented to the marriage. However, if either of the parties are under the age of 18, then in that instance they require parental consent as well as ministerial consent. Now, subsequent to that ECA judgment, the Department of Home Affairs, on the 6th of January 2022, that is this year, they then issued the directive that marriages concluded in terms of Islamic law, that is now Islamic marriages, can now be registered in terms of the Recognition of Customary Marriages Act. It does not make sense as to why the age and consent requirements would lead to a directive of this nature. And as far as the Muslim Judicial Council is concerned, we are saying that it's not really encouraged, or we do not see the benefit in registering the marriage in terms of the Recognition of Customary Marriages Act, because the consequences would not automatically be in terms of Islamic law. The consequences will, however, be in terms of existing South African law provisions. And this option of having your marriage concluded in terms of civil law has been there in terms of the Marriage Act 25 of 1961, which is also available. The only difference between the registration of the marriage in terms of the Recognition Act and the solemnization of the marriage in terms of the Marriage Act is that if we register the marriage, there will be the same date of the nikah when it is registered at the Department of Home Affairs. However, if a marriage is concluded in terms of the Marriage Act, there will be a new civil marriage with a new date. But the consequences, yes, in terms of both the Marriage Act or the Recognition Act, it will then be in terms of existing South African law consequences by default and not in terms of Islamic law, which is basically what the Muslims would want. As far as the question of La Bola is concerned, yes, I have seen the fatwa. And yes, this is also why there is a need to have some type of a structure in place for dealing with matters of the sort as well. And yes, the fatwa is quite a good one, as it does differentiate between the Islamic law automatic consequences and also what both parties or families to an agreement of this nature, where La Bola is concerned in the African community, can also agree mutually that they would want to have this as part of the marriage proceedings.
Yeah, I think you've answered the one where you said that if you subsequently have a civil marriage or even a customary marriage, that then trumps the nikah, and that's the regime that would apply rather than the nikah that you contracted. Is that correct? As I understood you, Sheikh?
Yeah, if you have the marriage concluded now in terms of the Marriage Act, which is available, then obviously that will then be the case. That will be the recognized marriage. And if you don't have a child, for example, then you don't require a customary marriage certificate or affidavit because the marriage or the marriage is already recognized. With the Recognition of Customary Marriages Act and the registration, they will actually recognize the actual date of the nikah, which might have been 5-10 years back. That would be the difference between the two options. But yes, the consequences is quite problematic because it is in terms of the African law consequences and not Islamic law consequences.
Yeah. Look, 18, there's now the minimum age of 18. Now, what if you're married, if you entered into it, I mean, a lot of our girls especially are under 18 when they conclude a nikah. What happens to them? Are they married? Are they not married? When they, 2 years later, when they turn 18, or 6 months later, when they turn 18, are they automatically married or they're not married? Any light you can throw on that?
Yeah, basically the requirements in terms of those sections in the Recognition Act, both parties should be the age of 18. It's quite interesting to note, however, if they enter into a civil marriage in terms of the Marriage Act, a girl at least, she can, however, get married with parental consent if she is 16. But if it is a boy or the proposed groom, he must, however, and he's also 16, he has to then acquire the parental consent as well as ministerial consent. So there is a discrimination between the two acts. But however, if a marriage has been concluded, it does allow for the parties to later on get the necessary consent. And if they also reach the age of 18, that that consent can also be remedied in terms of the provisions in the Act's consent.
Yeah. Is it an automatic thing, or they'd have to make some application when they turn 18?
Yeah, when they're 18, they would actually have to then get that condemnation in this regard, in terms of the provisions in the Act.
Yeah, and let's say you're a marriage officer, and not even a marriage officer, you're an imam, and you registered somebody under 18. There's no consequences, are there?
Yeah, if you're looking at the Recognition Act, it doesn't refer to the imam marriage officers, because the imam marriage officers were specifically given the authority or jurisdiction in terms of the Marriage Act 25 of 1961. So my reading of the directive, the Imam Marriage Officers won't be able to do that in terms of the Recognition Act. However, they are allowed to then, as currently as well, conclude the Islamic marriage firstly, and thereafter to solemnize the marriage on the mere fact that they are Imam Marriage Officers in terms of the Marriage Act. And yes, both parties should then be by 18, but the Marriage Act does allow that if it is not a prospective bride, she can be 16, and she just requires the parental consent without the necessity of also acquiring the ministerial consent.
Right. Now, both spouses need to consent to be married, right? Now, a lot of our nikahs are done by way of proxy for the female. Now, you know, there's no definitive rules regarding how nikahs are conducted. Can we have problems where they say, well, look, how do we know that the bride did consent? What if the bride later on felt aggrieved and said, look, you know, I wasn't fully informed. My proxy went there. I didn't know. Mine was not a consent or not an informed consent. Could there be problems arising regarding lack of consent, especially because of proxy representations being allowed for nikahs?
Yes, definitely. If you're looking at the wording of the judgment, it refers to the various sections of the Recognition of Customary Marriages Act, but only as far as the age is concerned and the consent is concerned. It doesn't refer to the formula, and that's the difference between the Marriage Act, which doesn't allow for proxy, and however, judgment, which only refers to the age and consent requirements. Definitely there could be possible problems with regard to the consent not being obtained, but I have not heard of any cases currently where they have entered into a marriage based on the CC judgment where problems of this nature has occurred. But yes, definitely it could be a problem, and therefore my advice would be that obtain the written consent at least of the parties, so that these type of matters will not become a problem later on.
And I think the bottom line is, the sooner legislation comes and sets out and we know where we stand, the better. Would you agree with that?
Yes, I definitely would agree with that. Like, if there was something like the Muslim Marriages Bill of 2010, then if that was enacted, then all of these matters would have been regulated in terms of that piece of legislation. Currently, we're looking at a court judgment that it might have been an oversight, but these type of problems could definitely also occur.
Okay. Jazakallah, Sheikh Munir, for your assistance and help in this matter. Shukran.
Munir, just one question. Okay, shukran. From our side, Amal, thanks. Just the one question, Aslam, is that if a couple is married by nikah, mutually decide to end the marriage, the husband is willing to do his Sharia responsibility to provide during the 3 month iddat period, after which he will stop. The wife initially agreed, but having become aware of the judgment, now wants 12 months maintenance plus a share of the husband's assets. What is the ruling on this, sir?
Okay, so the parties agree to divorce, husband's willing to do for the 3 month iddat period, and wife was happy, but now she's seen this judgment and she says, why should I settle for 3 months when I can get much more in terms of the civil law? The wife, I think, would be in the pound seats on the assumption that the couple had no agreement to the contrary. their marital regime defaults into out of community of property. Now, when she applies to court to dissolve the Muslim marriage, the Divorce Act applies. And she will get the same maintenance as others get in terms of the civil law. And then the court will also apply Section 7.3 of the Divorce Act, which was we've discussed previously regarding the redistribution of assets.
Okay, Aslam, thank you very much. Just to conclude, Amal wants to thank Radio Islam International and Radio Al Ansar very sincerely for repeatedly making their platforms available for the benefit of educating the Ummah in so many aspects, and that's one of the objectives of Amal. A shout out to the technical expertise of the support staff, Hafez Shweib Haji in Johannesburg and Hussein Umar in Durban. Assalamu alaikum from myself, Shabir Chauhan and Aslam Mayat. We will continue after the 12 o'clock news on Radio Al Ansar. Please stay with us on radio or via the link on your cell phones or computers. Shukran, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Assalamu alaikum.